thank my co-author, Nina Parikh, and acknowledge NCI for funding and a number of community-based organizations. And this is a study. What I'm going to talk to you about is Chinese tobacco behavior in New York City. But it's a pleasure to follow up these talks because I think some of the things that we're doing are informed and kind of take the next step in terms of looking at cultural differences and then designing effective interventions once we have those. Chinese Americans are being targeted by the tobacco industry, both certainly in China and come and immigrate into the United States. We've found a profound lack of knowledge, much higher than one would ever expect, of the harmful effects of tobacco on health. This was a study done in China, and the study that I'm reporting to you also found something quite similar. We have a huge, growing population of Asian Americans in the U.S., and New York City is no exception. We have particular neighborhoods where we see over 100% growth rates. And so we have worked with the health department and actually one of Ani's colleagues at Columbia University, Donna Shelley, to establish an intervention study of looking at the effectiveness of culturally sensitive interventions on Chinese American smokers. So we wanted to estimate the prevalence, attitudes and beliefs, tobacco use patterns, and then test the hypothesis that a linguistically appropriate, culturally sensitive intervention is effective. And these are some of our intermediate and long-term outcomes. And in addition, we're looking at the process of community capacity building in our New York City communities. And finally, because I'm a health economist, we want to look at the incremental cost effectiveness of a culturally sensitive intervention in addition to major interventions that have been going on in New York City that are citywide. We are theory driven. We're using whole combination of theories that I'm sure you're all familiar with. We use quantitative and qualitative. I don't do the qualitative, so I will talk about the quantitative. We have a population-based representative sample in two communities, and we have one was our comparison community, and one was our intervention community. These are the populations that in each of our Chinese communities, and we did compare the communities using census data, and they're significantly, statistically non-different, so that they do serve as good comparisons of each other. We did a telephone survey and worked with Westat as our survey partner. We developed our own questionnaire. We used a number of standardized questions surveyed all relevant questionnaires and did focus groups and back translated and translated into Chinese to make sure that this was meaning what we thought we were meaning. We had a very large, our intervention consisted of a multi-pronged, following all the guidelines for tobacco control, multi-pronged intervention, multi-level into the community, including media and community-based service intervention, provider education. We were in libraries. And media is obviously the most cost-effective. It's free, as long as you can get them to come to a press conference. And we're working with AFI, Asian Americans for Equality, that are incredibly effective in getting media involved. So everything we did was covered by five Chinese newspapers in New York City. In addition, we had some English-speaking newspapers as well. We launched our intervention. This is Margaret Chin, who's director of the Asian Americans for Equality. This was our former commissioner for tobacco from the Department of Health. We also engaged Councilman John Liu, who's a city councilman from Flushing area. And we had the Asian branch of the American Cancer Society working with us. And we did get some good coverage. I said, everything we did got into the Chinese newspapers. They're very thirsty for information. We marched in every Chinese parade and New Year's parade, and we stood outside of libraries and gave kids smoke-free air to try to get pledges from their parents and bookmarks, and really got involved in the community. And what was so gratifying is the community really came to join with our community-based leaders and really embraced this effort. We had quit and win contests. Okay, so what happened here? And we were also very interested in the question of acculturation and changing risk behaviors over time. Some of the data that I was quite impressed by were by Singh, who, out of NIH, who found over 15 years doubling in health risk behaviors. We used a random effects model to estimate the effect of the intervention. And this is the beginning of our data. The relevant numbers here, if you look, are with men, baseline and follow-up. You see a big difference in smoking rates. We had a 30% smoking rate when we undertook this study, and it is down to 22.9%. Now, that's not due to us, necessarily, at all, because while we were doing the study, it's like it's always what happens when you're doing quasi-experimental research in the field. Everything changes while you're in the middle of the field. So luckily, we're using two neighborhoods from the same city. One of our designs had been other cities, and frankly, we didn't do that, because in the middle of our study, the whole New York City changed. We had a new mayor. We have a very strong health commissioner. I don't know how many of you know about Dr. Tom Frieden, but his first priority was tobacco, and instituted a number of different events and interventions, such as nicotine-free replacement patches, free nicotine replacement patches, as well as we passed a new law, a smoke-free air law, in bars and restaurants. So all this happened citywide, so we can still compare these two communities and see what differences, and if our intervention makes any additional effect in our intervention community. So overall, we see a 24% drop in smoking rates. And this is the actions with men. Women have very low smoking rates, only 2% or so. Of course, this another important study is how we might prevent Asian American women from taking up smoking, and which is another population that's being targeted now. Where did we see the most change among young Asian American men? Compared to our comparison population, and those with lower levels of education. After our random effects model, controlling for all relevant socioeconomic variables and community and time period, we did establish that we had an actually statistically significant effect of additional 2.8% decrease in smoking rates due to our intervention. This is the first time this kind of study has ever been done. It's the largest sample of representative household-based sample of Chinese health patterns in the country. Knowledge is power. We actually did a paper, presented a paper, actually published a paper in 1994 in the American Journal of Public Health, testing a model of acculturation as a predictor of smoking. We found that not to be significant, and really a good public health interventions. Public health works, and here's a study that proves it. We're now examining further health behaviors. This was designed for smoking behavior, but we do have other health risk behaviors that we're looking at in particular. And what we see over time so far, very preliminary, we don't see any change in BMI or physical activity, but we do see a statistically significant increase in alcohol behavior. So that's to be continued. So thank you very much.
Statistical artifact of inappropriate allocation of ethnic background. The studies that I'm familiar with that have looked at what you just mentioned, a mortician who assigns the wrong ethnicity, have indicated that the rate of that occurring among Latinos is not so high as to account for the paradox. The rates are somewhere, it's way below 8% in terms of that as an artifact. The other thing I wanted to mention is that there are some data sets out there that don't rely on the mortician saying what the ethnicity was of the person who passed. They rely on what the person self-reported as their ethnic background. And so one of the reasons why I used the data set that we used for the study that I cited was that it was based on the National Longitudinal Mortality Study that was based on self-reported ethnicity, which then got matched to the death index on 10 different indicators to make sure that the record was being matched to the correct decedent. So if you haven't... That was one of 10. So Social Security, if that Social Security didn't match, there were 9 other indicators that was used that were used to assess whether it was the correct match. I believe that could be one of the potential explanations for the acculturation observation, and that is that, and I call it the immigrant mentality, which goes something like this. You as an immigrant come to this country looking for great opportunities, and you have high hopes that you'll actually make it. But perhaps the longer you're here, you realize that, wow, maybe I'm not going to make it the way I thought I was. But my children still have a chance, so it'll be good for them. But the children don't have the opportunity to reflect back on how... Because the immigrant is thinking, things are bad here, but they were so much worse where I came from. But my kids will have the opportunity. Well, the kids don't have the ability to reflect back on how bad things were before we came. They only have what they see here. So exposure to racism, to blocked opportunities with regard to ethnicity, discrimination in a lot of different spheres, including occupational opportunities, those could all be related to the worst health outcomes that we see. And certainly there is some evidence that smoking is associated with self-reported stress. So maybe that is accounting for some of these differences.
It's just interesting. One of the issues could be like to see what is the appropriate way to put the oxygen delivery service. For example, as we said, if we know that persons prefer to go to a private physician or to a specific setup, or what makes it easier for people to enter the system and to navigate the system. So apart from translating, you could as well, for example, say, is the whole clinic set up in a way that it makes it comfortable for the person to enter when they come in? What kind of posters do they see? How easy is it to find the place where you have to go? If you have to go to 5 different places, and how confidential is it as well? If you work with teens and family planning, for example, can they kind of go through the back door or something, or do they have to go front where it says family planning or STD or HIV clinic or something? And can they, if they go to a place, would they have to go be seen as perhaps by other people from their community, and then you don't want to go to certain services? So there are several kind of assessments as well available on cultural competence, self-assessments, or that a clinic can kind of go through and kind of see, how do I how does my clinic do in those things? Do we have cultural competence training? Are people being aware all the way from the receptionist to the physician of how to deal with certain populations? Sometimes as well what happens is that a clinic may see a lot of Latino immigrants, and then when they see other ethnic groups, all of a sudden you have an influx of South Asian immigrants to that clinic, then they are at a loss because they have bilingual staff, English-Spanish, and they are quite comfortable perhaps with certain cultural aspects of that population. But then when they see Hmong, Russian, South Asian populations, the smaller group, they are kind of at a loss, and sometimes the Spanish-speaking provider might then not discriminate, but kind of like not really know how to deal with certain issues. So just to say something.
I'm not sure which diseases specifically that you work with. I think one of the reasons that our study was as successful as it was is that over a period of 5 years, we had an 89% retention rate in a population of severely mentally ill women, many of whom were homeless, whom were substance using, which is an amazingly high retention rate. And I think the reason is that we utilized a model for our research that is very common for the delivery of health care in Latin America. And if you look at some of the literature coming out of Latin America, for instance, it's common to have community lay health workers, promotoras, which in Puerto Rico is called educadoras, who would go into the community. So our participants didn't necessarily have to come to us. We would go to them in their homes, in their neighborhoods. My interviewers are absolutely amazing. Because of the shadowing that we did, we were essentially available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We adjusted people's hours. If we had to be at an emergency department at 3 in the morning to shadow, we were there. And I think that that becomes a critical factor in the delivery of healthcare services, where, first of all, you have people who are accustomed to that model, who are not going to walk into an office where people don't look like them or don't speak the same language. One of the other issues we found, when I had mentioned that our Mexican cohort in San Diego County, we found that they had much significantly lower risk behaviors than our Puerto Rican cohort in Northeast Ohio. And when we looked at it, what those women were telling us is that once upon a time, their risk behaviors really were as high as our Puerto Rican participants. But what had happened is because of the stepped-up immigration enforcement near the border, they simply sequestered themselves. They stopped going to nightclubs. They stopped going to doctor's offices. They stopped taking their kids for healthy baby checkups. They stopped going to adult education programs. Even some of the, you know, we had a high percentage of folks who were undocumented in our Mexican cohort, but even people who were here as permanent residents simply stopped doing things because Border Patrol officers were boarding trains, they were boarding buses, they were checking people's IDs, and even if they were here legally, they potentially had family members who were not. So we saw if you weren't going out into their community to provide services, they weren't accessing them.
Ledge back there that you can fall off if too many people are here.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a really good question, and I think there's what we've learned working in the clinics, we learned from you guys who are public health practitioners, and one of them is to listen to the patients, because although qualitative researchers will say people don't know why they do know what they do. And so when we see what people do, we can sort of figure out why they do what they do, and we can fill in the holes. So, for example, why does direct-to-consumer advertising, why might it not work in a first-generation immigrant population of Hispanics? Well, because many of them come from countries where you don't have to get a doctor's prescription for everything, right? So the advertisements that end with see your doctor and ask about don't work in this population. You need to have the advertisements that educate about why you need to go to your doctor as well. And so, I mean, it's sort of like just think about what's going on. And I think the clinicians that are most successful in sort of helping to bridge the gap between what everybody thinks people are learning from advertisements and from any PSAs, maybe not even just from pharmaceutical industry, and from what people actually take in and can use and can change their behavior and improve their health, are the doctors that go beyond language and cultural competency and actually ask their patients what's going on. And I'll tell you, in the clinics, we rely a lot on providers that come from other countries as well to help us to try to understand what's going on. So, thanks.
Okay, guys, time is up, but don't leave, because as you know, we have the next session talking with journal editors, lessons and tips for getting your work published. With Dr. Sana Lu is going to stay with us, and we have a couple of editors from other journals, so have a little break and join us. Before you leave, make sure you get the pink package and the yellow package. The pink package has all the sessions for the organized by the caucus. All the sessions are on this build, in this building and this floor. Tomorrow night we have in the business meeting to say goodbye, meet new friends, make new friends and meet old friends. So make sure that you are here tomorrow night for our business session, social hour. And now I want a big round of applause for our panelists. They did a fantastic job. Very welcome to this small session on talking to, with, and to journal editors. I would ask you first if you want to come a little bit closer for two reasons. Number one, we really chose big rooms, and with all these competitive sessions, it's hard to get all together in this big room. So please come closer. And the second reason is that we really want this to be a more kind of conversation. You know, when we say, so in the, using Pablo Freire, a dialectical mode in which we learn from you guys and you learn from us, and this is based on being quite honest, asking the question that you always wanted to ask, and you either never dared to do, or you never got the answer you wanted, I mean the answer to your question. So we really encourage you to be very frank, open, honest, and if you want to say it, brave, to ask the question about how to get to the next step in getting your wonderful research published. To that end, I have with me today two wonderful colleagues of mine, Sana Lu, who is professor at Case Western Reserve University. Her primary appointment is in the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics. She's director of the Center for Minority Public Health, and she's also with the Department of Bioethics, Global Health and Psychiatry. And Sana is with us, among other reasons, because she's the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Immigrant and Minority Health. She has a long and wonderful career in editing, and she is the expert in knowing how to get research on immigration and health published. And then we have our colleague Stuart Landers, who is the interim director of the Bureau of Community Health Access and Promotion at the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. Did I say it correct? He's associate editor of the American Journal of Public Health for HIV/AIDS, LGBT health, community-based participatory research, and program evaluation. So we have two experts. And then me, I am Annie Villadrich, director, chair of the Caucus on Immigrant Health. I would like you to be aware of all the sessions that are posted on the pink package. We're having the business meeting tomorrow at 6:30 or 6 o'clock is here. In the same building, the room next door, we want to count on your expertise to make the caucus a wonderful opportunity for all of us interested in working on immigration. And I'm now a newly member of the board of editors of the Journal of Immigrant and Minority Health, and I will share with you, after my colleague, my own experience as a reviewer and as a writer, okay? And then we are all going to open the forum for your questions and discussion. So let's start with Dr. Lu.
this is going to be very informal. I thought I would just cue what our submission process is and what some of the common mistakes I think that authors make, both in their original submissions and in their resubmissions in response to reviewers' comments. And please feel free to ask questions as I go along if something strikes you, and I'll try to keep it within the time limits, even with questions. We moved to a completely electronic submission process on February 14th of this year. Before that, it was a much more cumbersome process. People would send in their manuscripts in hard copy and triplicate to me. I would find reviewers, send them out, wait for the reviews to come back. Everything was paper and took a lot longer. Now we have a website, which the easiest way to access it is actually just to put the title into Google and it comes up right away. And when you submit, it will ask you for your name, it will ask you for your email, you'll be assigned a PIN code so that you can re-access the site, and you can basically upload your manuscript. Well, what happens to it once it gets into the system? What happens is that this year we reorganized our editorial board, so we have what we call domain editors with responsibility for different areas of research. So we have one, for instance, who focuses on health services and quantitative research. We have a domain editor in the area of behavioral health and psychiatry. We have one for qualitative methodology who has stepped down, and we are now looking for someone in that area. And a few others who have varying responsibilities. Depending on the topic of a particular manuscript, it will be funneled to one of these domain editors, who's then responsible for locating appropriate reviewers for that manuscript. We try very hard to have a minimum of 2 reviewers per manuscript. And when you upload your manuscript, you have the opportunity to also upload a cover letter. And what we recommend to people is that if you know of reviewers who are qualified to review your manuscript, but who are not going to be in conflict and are not your buddies who are going to say, oh yeah, this is wonderful, no problem, feel free to suggest that in your cover letter, because particularly for some topics, it becomes more difficult for us to find reviewers, such as in the area of genetics or very specialized clinical care. So the manuscript will be sent to the reviewers, who are given a certain amount of time to review it. If we have difficulty finding a reviewer, it takes longer, obviously, to get the review back. Because we're now in an electronic system, you can check the website with your PIN code and your username 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to see what the status of your manuscript is. And it will tell you it's pending editor assignment, or it's pending reviewer assignment, or it's in review. And you'll be sent an email when the reviews have come in. Now, what happens when the reviews come in is they are reviewed first by the domain editor, who also then comments on the manuscript. Then I receive an automatic email, and I review the reviews of the reviewers, I review the comments of the domain editor and their recommendations, and then I make a final decision on this first submission. That's when the email, once all of that has been posted, then an email goes to the author saying the reviews have come in, a decision's been made, and then the author or authors can access the site and see what the reviews say. If a manuscript is accepted with revisions, or is recommended, or we recommend to the author to resubmit with major revisions, we give the authors 90 days to make those revisions and resubmit. If it's beyond 90 days, in most cases, we will consider it a new original submission. Now, the advantage of getting it in those 90 days is that because it's considered a resubmission, it goes back to the original reviewers, which is really to the advantage of the author. Because what can happen is if it goes out to different reviewers, it's just like a grant proposal. They will raise all kinds of concerns that the first set of reviewers never even saw. So it really is to the author's advantage to get it in within that 90 days. And then a decision will be made accordingly. we have adopted a policy this year of not allowing more than a second resubmission. So people have a first submission, they have one revision, they potentially have a second revision, and after that, if it's rejected, it's rejected. We only give essentially two more bites of the apple. Some of the most common errors, I think, or issues that come up for authors, one of the primary ones is not responding to reviewers' comments. In the cover letter or in the resubmission, quite bluntly blowing off the reviewers. And even if authors disagree with what a reviewer says, which can happen and the disagreement can be perfectly legitimate, it's really important to address every concern that's raised by the reviewers. And if you disagree, to say why you disagree or why you think your approach is more appropriate than what the reviewer has recommended. That, I would say, is a major problem. Another issue is we request very specifically that when resubmissions come in, for instance, that authors detail exactly where they have made the changes in the manuscript in response to each specific change of the reviewer. When authors don't do that, it makes the re-review significantly more difficult and it gets reviewers really angry. And you don't want a reviewer angry as they're sitting there reviewing your paper. You really don't. Reviewers, the people who review for journals are incredibly busy. You don't want them having to spend more time figuring out what you did and getting aggravated as you do it, because the review won't be of the quality that you need, and people will take out their aggravation, quite frankly, on the review, which I think is all too often natural. So that's, I think, a major issue. Not including a cover letter is somewhat problematic. Sometimes people will submit a manuscript, and the abstract doesn't really tell you what the manuscript is about, so it ends up getting diverted to the wrong domain editor, and then the review time is multiplied astronomically because it has to find its way back through the system to make its way to the correct editor. So you really want your cover letter to tell the editor a little bit about what the article is about. Is it quantitative research? Is it qualitative research? Is it a review article? Is it a large sample or small sample? What substantive area of inquiry is it? Is it economics? Is it healthcare access? Is it health services? Is it clinical care? And then if there are particular skills that you think the reviewer needs to have to do an adequate job of review, we really appreciate knowing that. I mean, we can obviously guess by reading the manuscript, but it makes our lives much easier. So if you're particularly if you're dealing with a much more esoteric area, it makes it really helpful. What are some other important issues? In the past, I think we have been more willing to work with newer authors to help them make their manuscript publishable than many journals have. If it's a subject that is sort of a hot topic where there's not much written about it. That is becoming less true as our editors and reviewers have become busier and as the quantity of manuscripts has increased. To give you an idea of what our acceptance rate was, our journal next year will be in its 10th year of publication. When we first started publishing, we had four issues a year. We probably had five or six articles per issue with a book review. We are now up to six issues a year. We publish a minimum of 10 manuscripts per issue, so it's 60 manuscripts. We probably are now averaging around 10 to 15 manuscript submissions per week. So that tells you what the acceptance rate is. And it's again, the submission rate had gone up astronomically once they became electronic. I think that's my short and sweet summary of where we are. Yeah. Do you have a question? Please. You might want to stand up so people can hear you.
Yeah, introduce Sharon.
Well, so everybody can hear you because there are people still in the back. In terms of the length of time? The short answer is it depends. If we can find a reviewer really quickly, we can generally get a review out in less than 60 days. If it takes a long time to find a reviewer, because we do like to have more than one review, I think the longest has been about 7 or 8 months. And that's not something we're happy about. But again, it depends on the specific area. Yeah. Reject.
Yeah.
If people have not organized their manuscript well, if the grammar is really problematic, if there are a lot of misspellings and typos in the manuscript, there's a basic structure for manuscripts depending on the particular topic and the particular methodology. So for instance, if it's a manuscript that focuses on epidemiologic research in general, you want to see background, you want to see methods, you want to see results, you want to see discussion. If there's no organization or it's an organization that's difficult to follow, that may, depending on everything else, result in automatic ejection. If beyond our accepted word limit substantially and it has not been cleared ahead of time, specifically with me, not only with the domain editor, it will be rejected. So for instance, for empirical research, we have a recommended word limit of 3,000. We have, in some cases, been willing to review articles as long as 5,000 or 6,000 words, but they have to be cleared ahead of time. And if they're not, they're automatically rejected, which doesn't mean that the reviewers also won't recommend shortening the manuscript, but that will be an automatic rejection. If the author doesn't include their sufficient author information to contact them, we will not spend the time to figure that out, and that has happened. Where people put their names and their emails, but then their emails become defunct and we have no other contact information. So those would be some of the basics, I think. Yeah. If I was unsure, I would probably email the editor directly and ask them. And even, if you're not sure even if a manuscript will fall within the journal's scope or mission, you may want to check that out with one of the editors before sending it in as well. You don't want your manuscript sitting there for months and only to be told, well, gee, this really isn't within the scope of the journal. And that's another reason for an automatic rejection. If it just doesn't fall within our scope, we're not going to consider it. Yeah. Part of the length of time, I can't speak for other journals or other editors. Certainly one of our difficulties where there's a long delay in getting reviews back to the author, it's usually because it's almost always because we had difficulty finding reviewers, or because we had reviewers who didn't follow through on their commitment, which meant that we had to go through the whole process and find additional reviewers. That very often is the case. I can tell you that all of our reviewers, when they get a manuscript, they are sent an email which contains a letter with our guidelines that everything is supposed to be confidential. They cannot sort of decide, well, gee, I'm not going to do this review, give it to my graduate students, that if they agree to do it, they are doing the review, that if they are in conflict with the researcher, if they or with anyone on the research team who's noted, if we haven't discovered that, they need to let us know and recuse themselves from the review and destroy the manuscript. To the best of my knowledge, we've never had a problem with that in the close to 10 years at this point, but, you know, never say never. What else can I tell you? I will tell you that I think the majority of our reviewers, and certainly everyone on my editorial board, works really hard for the journal, and no, people don't get paid for it. I mean, it really is a labor of love. Sometimes individuals may have been colleagues with someone or collaborators with them on other papers, and we may not know that. And so we ask that because they had such a close relationship that they not review a particular paper, even if they're not a named author. If someone has a competing research interest where they feel that their research interest is going to negatively impact their ability to give an objective review of a manuscript, we ask that they recuse themselves. Quite frankly, if there's a personal conflict between them, we ask that they recuse themselves so that they not review it. And many of these things we have no way of knowing. I mean, we can certainly do a literature search and see whether someone has co-authored with someone before, but, you know, if they're the 10th author on a paper with someone, it's not going to show up in PubMed. If it was a presentation, it's not going to show up many times, or it may simply not be accessible through the web. So those would be some examples. They're all blind reviews. They are not blind for the domain editors. They are all blind for the reviewers. And we initially had it blinded for everyone, including domain editors. And then what we found was that it became too difficult for the domain editors to later get the information when it was actually time to go into production, because people had moved and there hadn't been ongoing communication. It's a long story, but that's why domain editors are no longer blinded. And if they were blinded, then they wouldn't be able to find, to do the searches that they need to do to make sure that the reviewers were not in conflict.
So they could find themselves.
Right. Yeah. Are blinded and our reviewers are blinded, and for the most part I haven't gotten any complaints about it. I think it protects people on both sides, quite frankly. I'm a great believer in blinding. I review all reviews before I truly review every single review before it is sent to authors to try and make sure that there are that reviews are constructive, that they're not nasty, that there's no hint of an underlying agenda that we may not have picked up on. Where there is, the review is discarded and we look for another reviewer. I don't know whether it's to an author's advantage or disadvantage. I can say that in the 14 years that I've been having my work in this field published, in contrast to when I was an attorney for practicing law, I would say in only one instance was I not blinded to who the reviewers were, and that was because the reviewers chose to unblind themselves. And I don't feel that I was ever disadvantaged as an author. You always have, at least with our journal, you always have the right to protest the review. So if someone feels that a review has been unfair in terms of tone, I mean, you should always respond to all comments in terms of substance. But if someone feels that the review has been biased or prejudiced, they should certainly make that known to the editors. So we'll look into it. Other questions? Great.
Thank you. And we will have, you know, more discussion about the issues that you may have encountered in your personal experience of meeting. This is not going to be a therapy session, but you can actually inform us. Yeah, you could. Let's throw the pillows and, you know, crawl on the floor. So now we have Dr. Lenders, and he's also going to talk from the perspective of the American Public Health Journal. Okay, so welcome.
Hi, everyone. Well, first of all, I wanted to thank the refugee and immigrant section for inviting me to appear on the panel. And I think it was a great idea for them to do this because we, the editors at the American Journal of Public Health, do a session every year at APHA. It was this morning at 10:30, and we do it every year. But I know that there's a lot of conflicting sessions. And I think that targeting things like this to different groups and interests is really valuable, and I'm really happy to be able to come and talk some more about what we do at the American Journal of Public Health and answer any questions. I was pleased and surprised to hear Professor Liu's talk and realize how many similarities there are actually in the review process between the two journals. So that's a good thing, I guess. It means we're all figuring things out and coming up with some good solutions. I do want to say that over the past, I've been an associate editor for 3 years now with the American Journal of Public Health, and I think one of the things that's been happening over the past several years with the journal is that we are doing more and more to look at international issues, refugee and immigrant issues, that the visibility of those issues are much higher in the journal than they were previously. I think because it was the American Journal of Public Health for a while, people felt somewhat limited. Not that they weren't exceptions, but I think people have really taken a much more global approach. And so there's a lot going on in this area in every issue. We're also doing partnerships with international journals. So we've been linking to a health journal in Mali, in Africa, that is being organized by the National Institute for Environmental Health Services, NIEHS. And we are also beginning to look at issues of translation. So we have a little pilot going on right now where one of the editorial board members is working with his students, he's a faculty member at the University of Texas at El Paso, on having them do translations into Spanish of all of the abstracts. So yeah, we're very excited about that. And you know, we're trying to take it a step at a time. The thing we're working on most right now is that the quality of the translations be, you know, first rate, so that the tone and the scientific information is really translated accurately, so that when people review the abstracts, they're really getting the information that the authors intended. In addition to sort of this general increase in sort of outreach across cultures, as people may know, the theme for next year's American Public Health Association conference is Health Without Borders. And the American Journal always tries to publish a theme issue in November that meets with the themes of the conference. And so we are doing an issue on acculturation and sort of where it stands at this point. There's been kind of controversial waves in terms, I'm not an expert in the field, but in terms of where acculturation is academically. And what is unusual about this journal is that we don't put out a lot of call for papers. And I will say a little more about why we don't. But we have put out a call for papers on the area of acculturation. And the deadline is February 1st of 2008. So if there are people, you know, working in that field or know people working in that field, you might want to point them in our direction. Professor Liu was saying, the best way to understand more about submitting to the American Journal of Public Health is to go to the website. I don't know exactly when it went electronic. It was before I started there, so it's been at least 3 years. I think it was about five, if I remember right. And you can go to www.ajph.org. www.ajph.org. And there's a lot of information on the first page about the formats and about the different submissions, and I'll say a little bit about that. But the first take-home message is to read those very carefully, because it's very explicit. It spells out word limits, what the abstract should contain. But it can be a little confusing and a little overwhelming, because we have about eight different formats, and I'm not going to go through the kind of mind-numbing exercise of trying to explain them to you here. The basic one is research and practice, so that if you're doing a research study, quantitative or qualitative, for the most part, you'll want to go into a research and practice article. But there are also interesting things like field action reports, where if you're doing something really innovative out in the field and you want to put in a report with some preliminary data, it's an opportunity to get something exciting that's going on out sort of sooner. And those are kind of more descriptive in nature, too, so that while you should be submitting some data with those, you can also encourage you to put in pictures and brochures if it's outreach, you know, innovative things that could really convey to the reader what it is that you're doing and what's innovative about it. There are also editorials and commentaries that are really just sort of more thoughts about a topic that are not necessarily research papers. There are history papers in the journal. There are something called Framing Health Matters, which are longer versions of analytic essays that may not be your data, but may take data from different sources, may look at different articles and research in the field, and put together a picture to sort of show almost a meta-analysis of a particular topic. So really something that you might want to look at, but that isn't based on a particular single research study or intervention or single database that you've worked on. There's also a government and public policy set format and a health ethics format that sort of look at things in the public policy realm and in the ethical realm. So, and they all have slight differences, so it's, again, like I say, it can be a little overwhelming trying to figure out which to submit as. But I'll give you one hint. You don't have to worry about it too much. Do your best guess. Because our editor-in-chief and an assistant that she works with does all the initial screening of the articles. And if they think an article is of merit but was submitted in the wrong category, they will correct the category and then direct it. Similarly to, again, what Professor Liu said, we don't call them domain editors, but we have department editors for the different departments, and then associate editors like myself who do sort of a mix of different topic areas, content areas. And again, a lot of things are similar, so I won't repeat them all, but one point I'll make is this movement to electronic submission is really great, but it does increase the number of papers that have come in. So we're right now receiving about 210, 215 papers a month, and we're publishing 33. So, it's a little tough, but I'll tell you, one of the things that happens when you submit an article to the journal is that you go into our database, And one of the things that will happen when you go into our database is that you then become automatically enrolled in our reviewer list. So if you have any interest in you can just sign up to become a reviewer for the journal, and I'd encourage everybody to do that. But also, if you do submit an article, even if it's rejected, you would also be enrolled as a reviewer. And one of the advantages of that, I guess I don't really have to tell you that, is reviewing articles is a great way to hone your own authorship skills. Something like sort of having to sit down and take a look at someone else's paper and write a critique that, you know, sort of helps you, and I know it's helped me over the years that I've been doing this now, reflect back on how I might organize something or how I might say something better, or, you know, if I see things I didn't like in a paper, I try and avoid doing them myself, obviously. So that's, you know, that's something that is very open by choice or circumstance. And the other thing I just want to make a point about, and maybe this seems obvious to everyone, but the editor-in-chief, Mary Northridge, makes a big point of saying this, and I think it's really true. Nothing is considered submitted to the journal unless it is formally submitted through the website as an uploaded journal article. And what does that mean? That means if you talk to me, if you, you know, meet someone else, if you want to show somebody a paper you've written, it's not a submission, and you shouldn't view it as a submission. So. And I think that's a positive thing in a way, because it means you shouldn't take sort of casual feedback as definitive. I mean, I know a lot of people want to get that. Well, I have an idea, and, you know, I'd like to run this by you. And it's, you know, it's tempting. But, you know, partly because of the numbers that I've described, and partly because we really want to give everyone a fair and equal shot, we like to go through the peer review process, and we can only initiate that once a formal submission has come in. So, you know, I say that to encourage formal submissions and discourage kind of, for people to remember that if they do get informal feedback somehow from a friend of a friend who knows someone on the journal, you know, not to put too much stock in that and not to ever be put off by that if someone says, oh, that's been covered, or that's not a good idea, or anything like that. Similarly, we do blind our reviews, the author's name for the reviewers, the reviewers' names for the authors. We look for 3 reviewers, typically. And we go through our database and suggest names, and there is staff who can help them solicit those reviewers. And sometimes it can be very time-consuming. So I'll again echo the thoughts that were said before. Sometimes you get 3 people who'll say they'll review it. 2 of them submit the reviews. The 3rd one doesn't come in. And then you're kind of in this situation where, well, how long do I sort of try and press on the person who hasn't submitted versus kind of going back out to another, find another reviewer, which can take time too, and then you have to give them some time in fairness, so it can stretch the process out. And sometimes you can go forward with 2 reviews, but it is not unusual we were talking about this before it started, to have people really give different feedback. Someone say, greatest paper since, you know, sliced bread, you gotta include this, and someone else saying, this is a reject for whatever reason. So there are times when you really do want to have that 3rd review and not necessarily take that on yourself, which an associate editor can do. But, you know, it's nice to respect the peer review process, and we're all handling a lot of papers, so it's better not to try and do that. I will say one thing that I thought was interesting, and it came up in the discussion about author-suggested reviewers. Because I do think it's a very helpful thing to suggest reviewers if you're an author. It can help speed up the process. It can help expand the base of reviewers that the journal has. But I will also say the thing that I was surprised about was when I first saw author-suggested reviewers come in electronically as part of, you know, the fields that we look at. I was like, well, you know, why would I go to who they want me to review? You know, that's probably someone who, you know, they've asked to, you know, help them review it. Well, I learned that it's normally not the case. I mean, most people are suggesting people in their fields or colleagues, but it's rarely the case that they've actually solicited and asked them if they would review an article, partly because it's unethical, obviously. Partly, I've learned this because very frequently the author-suggested reviewers don't agree to do the reviews, and also often those reviews, when they do accept the reviews, they don't necessarily come back positive. So it may be...
Careful.
Yeah.
Who's your friend?
Who's your friend? Or just, you know, people do their best to make... People, you know, read the articles and give you their best take on it. And I think what's interesting is someone in my role sometimes does get to know reviewers and does get to know a little bit about how reviewers read things, whether they're harsh, whether they're easy, whether nothing that, you know, anyone has ever done but themselves is ever good enough. You know, there are all kinds of types, and you do get to know who they are. But often, you know, you won't know as peers who they are. So it is helpful for us to have additional reviewers pulled in, but I'll say it's probably, you know, a crapshoot from the author's perspective in many ways. I think in terms of conflict, the only thing I'll add to the discussion that we've had already is I tend not to choose anyone from the same institution. It's not necessarily a standard. I wasn't told to do that. But I know in the first few months when I was doing this work, several people came back and said, well, they're in my department. You know, I know this work. They're in my department. I can't do it. So just as a time-saving measure, if nothing else, to not get people turning you down, I tend not to do it. And you can understand why, because people don't want to be put in that position. It's complicated at many levels. They want to support their institution. They want their institution and their colleagues to succeed. They know the work very, 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 very well. In some instances, sometimes, you know, too well to be just looking at the paper and reviewing it on those terms. And then just in general, I'll say that getting published in AJPH is hard, and I give credit to the editor-in-chief, who has a very nice rejection letter that goes out to people saying, we get too many articles to publish. You know, we get way more articles that are capable of being published than we can publish. So it's a bit of an easy out, but to some extent, you know, you're going to get back, you might get back, if you are rejected, you're going to get back that says something to the extent of, you know, we get too many things to publish. So in a way, it's nice to, you know, the advantage of a peer rejection, if you will, is that you get some feedback on your article and you can learn something. Obviously, a peer acceptance is the best thing. But the thing that I think people look for in AJPH is what does distinguish this information from other information that's already out in the literature. And everyone has chosen to look at a problem or address something because it's unique in some way. I mean, if it wasn't unique, you wouldn't need to be putting your good talents to it in some way, because you could just do a cookie cutter and take something that's worked before, idea or a novel situation. So I think it goes to your advantage to sort of figure out what that is, ask yourself what is unique about this, and then try and highlight that both in the abstract and then early on in the paper, make that case based on existing literature. And the final comment I'll make before opening up the questions gets back to, again, a point that came up in the discussion with Professor Liu about handling reviewer risk comments. So the first thing I want to say is that if you get reviewer comments with a request to revise, that's a big win. That's a good thing. I mean, not everything makes it from there to publication, but a very, very high percentage of papers do that have been asked to be resubmitted. and they're telling you what it is that you need to address to get it approved for submission. So, I mean, Anahi was saying that, you know, she doesn't have the same emotional reaction. I said, I'm impressed she doesn't, because I still have an emotional reaction whenever I get that criticism, and that's a natural thing. Yeah. Yes, but I say this because I think it is hard to remember in that moment when you see pages and pages and sometimes pages of comments and criticisms that, you know, it feels overwhelming, it feels discouraging, it feels like someone's being critical, mean, nasty, all those things that we try and not have so much. But mostly people aren't, and what I've seen is that, and again, echoing what Professor Liu said, a point-by-point response. Most people lay out their criticisms with numbers, skip back with the same numbers, and to say what you've done and where you've done it so they can find it easily. I actually sent an author back a note recently who did that kind of brush-off of the reviewers, and it was a good paper, and the criticisms weren't that strong, but I said, you know, you really, this is just not, you know, maybe it's just, I don't know what I said, but I very nicely just said, gee, you might really help the reviewers out by doing this in a point-by-point response and explaining where you made changes and just saying, we've, you know, rewritten the article to correspond with the reviewers' comments, which is pretty much what they had said. So it's a good thing to get those criticisms. When you do make arguments about it, sometimes reviewers buy it, sometimes they don't, and will come back a second time, and then you have to, you know, make a decision about whether you're going to just come up with some better arguments or make some other. Sometimes you can make changes that aren't necessarily exactly, you know, what the reviewer may have said, but that address it, you know, coming at it from a somewhat different angle, and that is often satisfying people. What I found is even the most critical reviewers are often very positive when they see that someone has taken their comments seriously and given thoughtful responses. Most of them really aren't, you know, there to engage in a long, drawn-out argument. They're there to improve the paper and make it the best paper possible. So that's where I'll stop. Thank you. Well, we have two great editors for the history papers named Ted Brown and Elizabeth Fee. And there are actually three, believe it or not, there are three formats kind of that they cover. One is images of health, a second is voices from the past, and third is the main one that we have, which is I don't know, public health history. I'm sorry, I forget the name. Public health then and now. Thank you. I'm blanking on the easy one. So I think the things that I would suggest are again, you know, because history is broad in a way, the things that I would suggest, and Ted Brown did a presentation this morning that was terrific, is really to think about what is the argument that you're trying to make, and what is its relevance for today. He showed several of the public health then and nows that were published in the last 10 years that went back as far as the turn of the century or even before in some cases, that had incredible significance for the issues we were dealing with today, and topics, you know, near and dear to the section's heart, like how some of the surveillance methods that LA County public health officials used for disease monitoring for Filipino and Latino immigrants in Los Angeles County from 1910 to 1940, really interesting stuff. And very interesting when you look at some of the debates going on today around immigration and what some of the policies are around immigration issues. So I think really trying to develop a central argument, not being worried about, you know, whether it's coming from 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 50 years ago or 100 years ago. That's not the point. The point is, you know, what is the relevance looking back? Because, you know, a lot of times it does take some perspective on some of these issues to really learn the lessons. And a lot of times the research wasn't necessarily done at the time, where it was done through a lens that's different from our lens today. So people may not have thought that the surveillance mechanisms used by the LA County authorities, you know, were in, you know, in the 50s and 60s, they may not have been so bad, but looking at it through the lens of today, you could really see some of the stigmatizing, discriminatory behavior that was going on in this instance. So, so organizing what the point is, the theme, drawing from appropriate historical references, using good source material appropriately in terms of constructing the argument, those are the things I would suggest. Increasingly more of the journal is in color. I'm sorry I didn't bring this month's issue. There's a very interesting images of health on the Body Works exhibits that people have been doing and talking about some of the ethical issues around the displays of bodies. And there are four or five striking images that are all colored images in there. There is a new editor, I believe it's Alicia Knopp, who is the images editor, who'll be appearing on the masthead, if not as of, probably as of January. I actually probably shouldn't say it. I want to say it's Knopf, K-N-O-P-F, but I'm actually not positive. So she is charged with managing that section along with Ted and Elizabeth, so you can certainly submit things to her to talk with her about ideas, because as a department editor, there's a little bit more flexibility. I mean, I would do it through email. Yeah, I mean, images are a little different, so it's a little harder to say, because it's, you know, it's a department where we generally tend to depend on the editors to kind of develop ideas and put them forward rather than simply rely on submissions. So the good thing is that there are fewer submissions. So I think you could be a little more flexible in terms of saying, you know, I have some thoughts, I have some ideas, if you want to share an image, and perhaps go from there. You know, I don't know of any particular resource, but I've actually thought about that a fair amount lately. And you know what I tend to do, as much as anything, is I tend to take, if I'm working on a particular topic, I would, and say I have a pile of background research articles like this or that or whatever we've got, I tend to take the three or four articles I think are the best, and I go to their bibliography, and I look at who they are citing and what journals those citations come from. And I think that's often a good starting point, just to sort of develop a list. And then the next piece of work is a little more challenging, because then, you know, you really do need to go to the journals themselves and take a look at their table of contents and their submission guidelines and see whether it's a match or not. But short of, you know, talking to a research librarian, I mean, librarians are great resources. And if you're attached to any institution that has a librarian in it, that's the other, you know, thing is that I, you know, place I would go for recommendations.
I think how do you choose the journal's position also depends on where you are.
Chris in the back. I mean, the numbers are just of submissions are just continuously increasing. On a, if you look on a quarterly basis, you can see it. So I don't know where it can end. I mean, I don't know how I would know, but it's currently up. Yeah, we just looked at those numbers over the weekend, and we have a great statistician, biostatistician, who's our statistics editor, Roger Vaughn, who did a nice job producing a lot of statistics for us, which are all based on medians. He's insisted, and I'm saying this because I think it's a big trend that we should encourage people to use medians rather than means for these things. And overall, from submission to acceptance, we're talking about around 120 days, around 4 months. From submission to publication, we're currently talking about 12 months, which is a long time to go from there. So there's kind of been this, some of it's production, but there's kind of a dead time, almost in part because we're somewhat backlogged. I will say that numbers seem to be going down, and one of the reasons it's going down, which is an exciting development, is that as with many, many journals now, the online publication of articles is now the official publication date of articles. And I think people, it's going to take a little while, but people are more and more accepting and getting used to this. So in fact, we may now accept an article in April. It may wind up in our first look section as a published article in August. But may actually not appear until our October or December even journal. And it's a way to get the information out quicker. It sometimes allows us to do some better grouping of papers so that they still hang together as a theme, but not holding things up to wait for that. And it's very exciting. We're calling it rolling production. And it's happening now, but it's really this year, coming year, you're really going to notice it a lot more, and increasingly more people are looking at the journal online and so really seeing what's out there from that perspective rather than waiting for the paper issue. And, again, I'm making my little pitch here for median, so remember that means that half of them are less and half are more. So it could be sooner, it could be longer. Yes? You should submit to one journal at a time. It's not a good idea to submit to multiple journals because, first, if something's good and is starting to head towards acceptance in both places, you would have to pull it, and the journal would not look very kindly towards pulling a paper that they like and they're supporting and they're putting effort into, and. So I will say that the rejections tend to come quicker than the acceptances. So you may have one thing at AJPH is you may wind up with a quick rejection if you want to then put it somewhere else. Just because of the numbers. But you're right; it could get stuck there for a while, and it's not a guarantee that. Right. Yeah, I never want to discourage submissions, but I do think if people feel strongly about getting information out in a really short time, it's probably not the best place. kind of more like the Public Health Journal of Records, in a general sense. Professor Liu did a great job of that, and and I don't want to be repetitive, but I will say, to some extent, the numbers that have turned into AJPH, it may just be, just being an average paper in some respects. That if there's not something that makes it stand out and really be exciting in some ways, or very high quality research or very, very cutting edge in a particular field, it may just be, sent along just because of the sheer numbers. I think a lot of the points that Professor Liu made make a lot of sense in terms of not following formats is probably the biggest one, because the sense is, if someone is capable of doing high quality research, they should be capable of following the research format from the submission page in the journal. But yet a lot of people don't do it. And then things like were described to people not giving proper contact information, those things do happen and are also grounds for a quick rejection. Yes. Well, the first question first, which was qualitative. Okay, I don't have a percentage, but I will say it's growing, whatever it is, whatever the number is. It's generally growing. I think people have become, across the board, more understanding of the importance of good qualitative work. And one of the things our electronic reviewers do is list the areas that they have skills in, and certainly qualitative research is listed there. When I have a qualitative paper, I try and make sure it goes to someone who's identified qualitative research as their area, so that it's not, why send a qualitative paper to someone who only has quantitative background? It's just asking for, someone who just doesn't want to cross that line and thinks everything on the other side is not good. I think sometimes it's difficult to shape, and I think it's also sometimes more difficult to evaluate the quality of the analysis, the selection of respondents, some of the decision making. I encourage people who do qualitative work to really, just kind of dig into the literature and really make the case for why. What I sometimes get frustrated by is even having a fairly, good qualitative paper that still was pretty sloppy about how focus groups were selected. Well, we chose groups, we recruited groups in four cities, in urban centers, through community health centers, and then a fifth group at a conference that we were at, because we were there and people were there. And, you hate to reject, and I don't think we're rejecting it on that basis, but if you're going to, follow a methodology, follow a methodology. And if everything else was geographically based and through a healthcare setting, why pollute the methods unnecessarily? Because it was convenient. Yeah. In terms of hot topics, for one thing, when you do go to the site, I believe you can see the themes for the coming year. I'm not sure. Well, that may not be true because they do shift. So that may not be true. You can certainly look back at the themes. So you can certainly look back at the theme issues for the past two or three years and see the type of topics that have been selected. It's hard to say. I mean, I think innovative work in disparities, a lot of the work around, I was just looking at sort of health inequalities that kind of goes beyond disparities and look at sort of inequalities in various aspects of life and the impact on health. I think topics related to sort of resiliency and protective factors tends to be something that kind of cuts across a lot of different content areas. I think socio-ecological models that look at different factors at different levels impacting people, such as individual, family, neighborhood, community, school. I think those are things that people are seeing as really understanding how individual choices and outcomes are impacted by sort of more complex realities and different ways of thinking about it than we had in the past, which is, you know, you have an intervention, you give that intervention, and that intervention works or doesn't work. No, I would discourage it in this case, especially partly because, again, you know, we're not completely volunteer, but we're close. We're like really teeny stipend to do this, and they're doing a lot of work, and it takes a lot of time. So, and it's just not it's just you know, in the end, I when I've had some challenging situations. Particularly, you know, my first year when I was less certain about how to do it, the editor-in-chief always said, well, you know, what, how'd the reviews come out? You know, if there were two rejects out of three, why would I overturn it because I had a conversation with someone? That would really be disrupting a process that is meant to provide independent peer review. So, You know, I think in a rare situation, perhaps maybe if you had some very complicated responses that you maybe had really difficult problems with, you could sort of say, gee, is this something I could talk with you about how to handle? But in general, I don't encourage it because it's just not, it's not feasible, and in most cases, it's not going to affect the outcome. Well, you know, I said the opposite. I don't know if you were in here for it. I said nothing is submit till it's submitted. So, yeah. Again, I would sort of say, you know, look at the journal and decide for yourself because, you know, in terms of, like, the American Journal of Public Health, I mean, almost everything people, you know, people does is fair game. Now, for example, maybe here's a somewhat counterexample. We tend not to do as many methods pieces. Yeah. But in the end, you know, sometimes people will submit them anyway, and sometimes they're so good that we publish them. So you know, you do that at your somewhat at your hazard, but it's yes, no, that's right, no, right. Yeah. I mean, things, like I say, though, things would turn around quick. If it's a methods piece of no interest, it, you know, it'll be turned around in less than 2 weeks. Yes. I mean, there is some discretion. The associate editor in charge does have discretion in that, but for the most part, one does that because it's easier to do that. The reviewers tend to expect it, and it just in the way it makes it life easier for the authors, it makes life easier for the associate editor to not be starting with fresh reviewers. Yes, all of that. Yeah, I like the reviewers that, you know, come back. This seems like a new researcher. I'm like, not really. generally speaking, you can sign up and not, it's not a commitment to do anything. You can just put your name up there and express your areas of interest. It's a big data set, so one of the things I would say is you probably want to put in somewhere between, you know, 6 and 12 areas of interest, because if you put in fewer than that, you know, you're going to get only a very, very limited swath of papers, which, you know, isn't the worst thing, but it's at least the way I select reviewers, I like to look at multiple criteria. So it helps if you put a couple of content areas and a couple of technical skills like qualitative research or surveys or things like that. And what generally happens is you would get an email asking if you're willing to review the article. You generally have a week to respond to that email. And once you accept, you have 2 weeks to do the review, and then there's sort of a grace week. So I would here's a couple of tips on that. One is when you get the request to review the article, you can go and look at the article online. So if you get a request, if you sign up to be a reviewer and you get a request to review, look at the article right away. If you think you want to review it, and you're a little concerned about the time pressure, Take the 6 days you need to say yes, and you'll buy yourself an extra week. Not that I'm encouraging people to slow things down, but I'm just giving you a little tip. Right. And if you don't have the time over that next 2 to 3 week period, just say no. It's not a personal thing. And it happened, you know, again, we're dealing with lots of papers and lots of reviewers, and you're much better off to have just declined a request. People aren't going to see, you can see that in the system, but it's not a big flag. You have to kind of look for it, and it doesn't jump out. But if you take, you know, 60 days to turn around a review, I mean, normally you'll be cut off, but I guess they slip through because you sometimes see someone who had 60 days to turn around a review. Or people who didn't complete reviews, then you really don't want to go back to them because you want to get it done. And you don't really want to go to someone who has a track record of not completing a review or taking, you know, a really long time to do it. Yeah, the way it works, you can actually sort of cut and paste into a field that can expand to any size, or there's an upload function where you can just upload it like you would do any attachment. Which sometimes people do because they put into PDFs, which is tough because, again, we were talking before, the associate editors can actually do editing of some of the reviewers' comments if they think they've been really inappropriate and just rude. And I've never really done it because I feel funny about tinkering with people's words. But when people put it in a PDF, you can't do it without assistance unless you're tinkering. Right. You could do it on your own, put it into a Word document, and then when you're ready, go to the website and upload it. Either cut and paste it or upload it.
Not just based on what is the topic, also what is the disciplinary
endeavor. So if I submit something to Culture, Medicine, and Psychiatry, a top journal in medical anthropology, I have to cite the medical anthropology literature. Just as an example, I just published one article there, and it took me a year to go over the revisions because I had this wonderful literature on social capital, because my work was on social capital and access to health networks, but I didn't cite the major people in medical anthropology who worked on social capital. So I did have to do extra homework. There was nothing wrong really with the substance of my paper, but this is to say, to build upon my colleagues, the whole point of you getting published, besides the fact that it has to have a structure, is to say something new. To repeat ourselves, to say what somebody else already said, is not going to let you move forward. So one of the tricks, but tricks in the sense that you have to do that very early in the paper, is to say to what extent your topic has a new vision, provides a new way to understand a topic, a contribution, maybe theoretical, maybe empirical, maybe practical, about something that has been done before. That's why you're doing the literature review, so you're not inventing the wheel, but your approach is unique and original. We want the same that you want. We want your great work to be published. Quite often, I found the originality of a paper in the conclusions. Quite often, the topic of the main topic of the paper is buried because everybody, you know, the author got lost in all discussing all the literature, and they also forgot to say why this paper means something new. The other thing related to this, talking about selecting papers, is choosing empirical-based journals from theoretical. You know, even the health sciences, we have journals that are more theoretical or demand a theoretical approach. And just to give you an example, one of my first papers published, I mean, I have written from tango lyrics to Latino healers to, you know, Latinas and body image, so I have a very diverse. And I remember once I submitted an article, was on very empirical because I come, you know, I got my PhD at Columbia University in sociomedical sciences, so I was trained the last years of my graduate education more empirical-based kind of research. So I worked, my paper was on tango immigrants. I work on the tango musicians who are undocumented, very exciting. Everybody in the health science literature said, okay, this is good, you have to look at the methodology. But guess what? I submitted the paper to a journal of contemporary ethnography, which is a very good journal, mostly managed by sociologists, many of those who are very good theoretically. And one of the reviewers said to me, something like, and I wrote it down, I never forgot, that the reviewer said, and I think he was a male. For some reason, you always get, is she a good man? You know, when they get, oh, this is a very sexy topic, you know. A guy will say something like that. And I was really seduced by the author's narrative, but I realized by the end, after I was able to pull out all the nice stuff, I realized that there was no theoretical model. You see? I mean, there was nothing wrong with what I said about the tango, but this was not for the New York Times. It was supposed to be a contribution from an ethnographic perspective to a journal that tries to bring together ethnography with good theory. So I got a very long letter by the editor, and this is one of the best letters. It was a 3-page letter. We basically, the editor did what Sana has done with some of the authors, saying to me that he couldn't, and he was a male, the editor, he couldn't accept my paper, but since he saw that the topic was really interesting, he actually gave me a roadmap on how to rewrite the whole paper. That person, even today, I thank that person for what he did. It took me 2 years to get that paper out, and guess what? This is one of the papers that has the highest hit in the journal. So in the end, when you put so much work into things, meaning that you're revising and, you know, 3 or 4 times something, that means that your end product is a much better product, and that's what the importance of it. So it's not a matter of just getting published. Sometimes you go to lower level journals, where they have a higher publication rate, but in the end, not that many people are going to cite your work. Not that many people are going to think that what you do is respected in the field. So maybe you need, on the one hand, it's a trade-off, to look for journals that have a higher turnover and you will get response faster. But on the other hand, when your career, along with your moving with your career, you want to look for good journals for you to get good feedback and good reputation in the field. What else I wanted to say? Don't get discouraged. There's no clear science here. Should we write to editors? Shouldn't we write to editors? I will say, these top editors here from top journals, at this point, they get more email than they can handle. My suggestion is, if you're looking for, you're new in the field, you're looking for new journals, editors that are not so overwhelmed, it's not a bad idea to ask an editor. Three things may happen. You won't get a response, so too bad. You may get a response saying it may work and may not. If you get it may not, you move to another journal. Or you may get a response, the third possibility, when the editor tells you, yeah, this is a good idea. Great. This doesn't mean that the editor is approving your idea. This doesn't mean that even after you submitted the manuscript to the journal, the editor is in any obligation to either send it out for review or hold it for whatever reasons. So, but at least it will give you a sense that maybe because of the topic, it's going to be considered in upcoming issues, maybe because the editor has an interest in what you're doing, it may give you a sense. Don't do that, I would say, with top journals, with editors that are overwhelmed with, and also from top journals, you already have a lot of information out there. Don't, give extra work when it's so much about the journal, the American Journal of Public Health, there is so much out there about the Journal of Immigrant and Minority Health. So do your homework. Look what are the previous issues are about. Think about if anything new you could say. They are publishing about the same topic. Why should I publish, send this manuscript about the same thing that it has been published three times in the last 4 years? So is anything new I can say about this topic? Doing the homework, I would say, is one of the biggest problems that we reviewers have when we get articles. We get articles that have grammatical mistakes. Look, English is my second language. How did I become good doing this? By doing it, by reviewing my own work, by giving it to colleagues. So maybe before sending it out to an editor, to a journal, give it to your friends, give it to your mentor. Get feedback. So when you send something out, make sure that you feel you are proud of your little baby. And manuscripts are our little baby. But then when you get the comments back, don't feel that the mean person really beat it up the little baby. Take the comments with a grain of salt and think that we are all here for the same reason. Those who send the manuscripts and those who review them on the other side. That's all from my part. I don't know if you have more comments from your experience. We have, time is up, but we have a couple of minutes. And before you go, again, I'm repeating myself 10 times. The sessions, remember, the Caucus on Immigrant Health, we have a full day tomorrow, not a full day. We have actually only two sessions in the same building, this area, the business meetings with food, music, I'm just kidding, food and drinks. The business meetings is November 6th, tomorrow Tuesday, from 6:30 to 8 p.m. We want to hear from you. We want to learn how to move this caucus forward, so we are looking forward to your being here. Thank you very much. And a big applause to our